We continue with this series on the Ten Commandments. Tonight my subject is the ninth commandment. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. The ninth commandment is the first to make mention of the word neighbor. Nevertheless, it is thy neighbor who is covered in the second table of the law, the last six commandments upholding the crown of divinity. It seems almost a truism to say that no one can break any of these laws except against the person near him who is his neighbor. The traditional summary of the law quoted by Jesus as covering the entire second table with the commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, makes plain sense. Yet a tremendous effort has been made for decades to reduce the law to nonsense and make it of none effect by redefining neighbor. We are taught from the cradle on that our real neighbors are not the people near us, but the people farthest away. That is supposed to be so because of jet planes. Children are taught that they must love their world neighbors or neighbors in Africa with a shameful disregard for the fact that such neighbors are of necessity imaginary and unreal. And the real task in life is to accept the dignity and humanity of real persons whose independence and dignity are impressed upon us often most uncomfortably simply by their near presence. The first law of the second table commands honor to the nearest persons we know, father and mother, to be superseded only by one still nearer, husband or wife. Tonight we discuss the crime of making a false accusation against another person, who must also be near, since normally no other accusation would be entertained at all. Perhaps in this connection I should deal with the verse from Genesis, which is so often thrown into any discussion of law and order. That is the smart aleck quip which Cain blurted out in defiance to his creator after he murdered his brother. You remember God asked Cain a perfectly natural question, which as far as Cain was concerned, might or might not have been prompted by God's knowledge of the murder. God simply said, where is Abel thy brother? But Cain, smeared with guilt, snarled in reply, am I my brother's keeper? God does not answer that question. It didn't deserve an answer. Clearly he is not his brother's keeper. But Cain betrayed his guilt by asking it. It is one thing to be your brother's keeper and to deprive him of responsibility for himself, to be his master and to have him for your slave. To be his jailer is what the word keeper really means. It is another thing to murder him or to steal from him, or to accuse him falsely of a crime so that he will be destroyed. Cain tried to cover up his criminal action by raising the question of slavery. Nowhere in Scripture do I find Cain's rhetorical question answered in the affirmative, yes, you are your brother's keeper. In fact, the answer is quite the opposite. The psalmist sings, but no man may deliver his brother, nor give a ransom unto God for him, for it costs more to redeem their soul, so that he must let that alone forever. Yes, it is one thing to assume responsibility for my brother's welfare. It is something else again to refrain from telling a lie about him to the judge. Now, the ninth commandment makes it a crime to accuse him falsely. The matter, again, is integral to the whole operation of law and justice. There can be no action at the bar apart from the determination of the facts in question. And the determination of any fact depends upon the witness of some human being. The only way we have to determine what happened is that a witness appear who will testify of his own personal knowledge. The only way to bring about the punishment of a criminal is for some person to bear witness of his personal knowledge that the crime was committed by the accused. Legal machinery among the people of Israel put a burden upon every adult male to participate in the execution of justice. The witness, by virtue of the unique information he possessed, became automatically a public official, personally responsible to initiate a trial and upon conviction to cast the first stone in the execution. Among us, this terrible responsibility is once removed in the sense that we delegate the responsibility to certain officials. Nevertheless, the public prosecutor is merely the agent of the person who is the real witness. It is still the witness to the crime who holds the key to whether the criminal will be punished. He, too, is a public officer. By virtue of what he has seen and heard. I think it should be emphasized that no man can testify except to what he himself has seen and heard. I am a witness only to that of which I have personal knowledge. I may repeat the witness of another, for I am witness to his witness, but I am not then witness to the fact. Now, quite as clearly, there is a powerful temptation upon all of us to abuse or confuse the function of witness for any number of reasons. Children learn very quickly that by tale-bearing they can get their older brother into trouble. It's so easy to get him spanked simply by telling on him. And it's just a short step, then, to tell something only guessed at, but not really seen or heard. And that, according to a commonly accepted principle of morality, without even considering legal practice, is wrong. Moral judgment on it is illustrated by a story about Abraham Lincoln. It seems that the charge that Mr. Lincoln was an infidel was freely made in his campaign for Congress against Peter Cartwright, whom he defeated. Mr. Lincoln replied to the charge with a letter to the editor, in which he said in part, I quote, "Mr. Woodward may have believed what he said, but there is, even in that charitable view of his case, one lesson in morals which he might, not without profit, learn of even me, and that is never to add the weight of his character to a charge against his fellow man without knowing it to be true. I believe it is an established maxim in morals that he who makes an assertion without knowing whether it is true or false is guilty of falsehood, and the accidental truth of the assertion does not justify or excuse him." That is the end of Mr. Lincoln's quote. The law must hold every witness accountable. Otherwise, the courts would clearly become instruments of grudges, fears, hatreds, and wickedness. Courts would become the agents of violence and chaos and not orderly process if they could not punish severely any departure from absolute honesty and precision on the part of any witness. The usual legal procedure is set forth in the book of Deuteronomy. If the witness shall be a false witness and have testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to have done to his brother. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. There have been times and places among Christians, as in 16th century Geneva, when it was common practice for the accuser to be jailed at the same time as the accused. One of them was guilty. In this connection, it is worth quoting an appeal made by the heretic Michael Servetus from prison, not to recall the issues aroused by that affair, but to point to the evidently common practice of the law. He wrote to the Geneva Council as follows: "The gentlemen, I demand that my false accuser, John Calvin," false only according to Servetus, "be punished with the lex talionis, and be detained prisoner as I myself until the case be finished by the death of one or the other of us, or some other punishment. And for this purpose, I formally indict him with the said punishment of the lex talionis. I am content to die if he is not convicted, either of this or of other things which I shall bring against him." It is interesting to note that Servetus admits his own guilt of false witness by saying that he knows he can show his opponent is guilty of something, if not false witness, if only he can get him into court. It's also worth noting that Servetus' real accuser was not John Calvin, but a man who had spotted him in the church and who was imprisoned at the moment of the heretic's arrest. The law and the principle stand today in Texas and in the rest of the United States. Every person under Christian law has recourse both in criminal and civil courts against false arrests. We have that recourse even against the policeman. Our police officers are not empowered to make arbitrary arrests. They may act only upon their own witness to apprehend a criminal, or upon information solemnly sworn to in a warrant. Any person, official or not, who gives false testimony causing arrest is then severely dealt with. I'm informed by the district attorney's office in Houston that in Texas there are only 7 crimes for which the death penalty may be assigned. One of these is bearing false witness in a trial in which the death penalty is returned and carried out. "Ye shall do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother." That is the law in Texas today. Those enemies of God's law today who try to abolish the death penalty for murder on the grounds that it is possible to have a miscarriage of justice would do well to consider the whole law which would enact the death penalty upon anyone responsible for such a miscarriage. There cannot be any miscarriage of justice apart from false witness. Certainly the matter is of deadly seriousness. But the argument that a murderer should not be punished because some men are liars is absurd. 2 wrongs cannot make a right. It is necessary to enforce rigidly the whole law. It is those who would openly seek to abolish the whole law of God with whom we are really concerned. For if God's law is not our law, then we have no choice but to submit to a regulatory state, which is what men mean by a totalitarian tyranny. A state that does enforce the 10 commandments would punish its own officials who tried to arrogate to themselves God's powers to make laws and to regulate life. Such a state would then be God's minister testifying to his power and glory. And the only way a state can escape thus serving God is that it not enforce God's law. That would mean that it must impose a whole new system of law which looks to the control of every detail of the lives of its subjects, since it cannot punish crime. And just as there is only one way to build an arch, there is only one way to build a government, not under God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that is a government of the Antichrist. And the government of the Antichrist is characterized by three features. It requires its head, a man, to be worshipped as God above all that is called God. Two, it accomplishes amazing mechanical and scientific signs and wonders to bedazzle the minds of men. And three, it regulates the market. No man can buy or sell without a license or a ration coupon. Now, false witnesses are not the enemies of the Antichrist government, and they go unpunished in his realm, as do murderers, thieves, and adulterers, and all other criminals. They are not punished, they are corrected and taught to commit their evil deeds in a kindly manner. The kindly manner seems to have something to do with loving thy neighbor against whom one has falsely informed, or whose goods one has seized, or whose life one has taken. This alternative is no idle fear. It is the actual procedure of every socialist tyranny we have ever seen, from the Soviet to Castro's Cuba. And there is no more vivid picture of the National Socialist Terror of Germany, or the International Socialist Terror of Soviet Russia, than that of hobnailed boots tramping up to the door in the middle of the night. We read too much to doubt the reality of the stormtrooper who knocks at the door and seizes a member of the household and carries him off into oblivion without any charge being made, without any witness produced, any conviction determined. Informing is a necessary part of the machinery of a totalitarian government, and informing cannot proceed if the rules of true witness under God's law are observed. We are told repeatedly from Cuba as elsewhere that the first thing that happens after a revolutionist takes over is the bloodbath turned on by the informer. Men are encouraged to inform against their neighbors. Gossip, hearsay, guesswork, anything that might give a hint of defection or of a lack of zeal for the new regime is devoured hungrily. Those informed against have no recourse, no protection. And they usually have become enemies of the state, if they were not already so, by virtue of their false arrest and their treatment. Therefore, they must be done away with as a preventative measure. They are eliminated, not punished. No action need to be taken by such a government against the informer, because he, by virtue of his guilt, is psychologically committed to continue his informing and to betray all persons, father and mother, friends and children and neighbors, to continually ingratiate himself with the state. Surely it is an indescribable horror for a government whose true mission it is to exact vengeance upon a false witness, to foster and encourage false witness. Yet I cannot see how it is possible for a government which does not severely punish a false witness to avoid encouraging him. In fact, the welfare state must encourage him in the normal course of its regulatory procedure. And if nothing else, human carelessness inclines every one of us so that we need the restraint against wild guesses and strong statements which amount to false witness without necessary intentional malice to start with. And I see no reason to suppose that intentional malice has disappeared among us. Here I am sure it is necessary to mention the question of calling people communist sympathizers. Many people are said to be such. Others raise a hue and cry as though to say so were to bear false witness. However, let me observe that as far as I know, to accuse a person of sympathizing with communism is not to accuse him of a crime. Moreover, the accusation is subject to determination. That is, it can be demonstrated that a person did openly sympathize with the aims and methods of communism, if he did. The truth or falsity of the witness is subject to determination. And if damage is done falsely to the accused, there is plenty of recourse under God's law. And I find no shrinking horror among many men, clergymen as well as others, openly to express sympathy with what they themselves call communism. I find no reason to doubt the general reliability of what these men say as being what they mean, and I find no reason to suppose that they do not understand what they are saying, and therefore no reason not to call them communist sympathizers. Otherwise, nobody could be held accountable for what he said. And further, it is a specific count to say, so-and-so was identified by such-and-such in a published sheet as being associated with an organization which itself has been identified by so-and-so as a communist front. That is a statement of personal knowledge of a determinable fact. If the published information is false, there is plenty of recourse against the publisher. Finally, in this connection, let me observe that if the most horrible sort of accusation we can imagine is to accuse a person of being a communist sympathizer, then think how horrible a thing it must be to sympathize in any way with communism. And sympathizers who resent so dearly being called sympathizers are in fact expressing condemnation of themselves, which is not necessarily implied in the plain statement of a fact. And I think I must add another observation. Revulsion against an evil does not ensure freedom from it. Those sins we commit are usually the ones we most abhor. You know the old jingle, the sins we are most inclined to are the ones we've most a mind to see in others. There's another facet of false witness in the area of slander and libel. Clearly, damaging witness can be borne and is borne against other people without benefit of law courts. To make a public accusation, either by spoken word or by written word, is often almost as deadly to a man's good name and his life and his property as false arrest. And so it is a crime among us not only to swear out a false warrant, but even to publish false accusations. I don't suppose any group of persons is more conscious of the libel laws than newspaper reporters who every day have a sort of legal judgment hanging over their heads. I can assure you the libel laws are real. They are effective and they are enforced. Rare is the man who will not seize an opportunity or even the obligation to clear his name against a matter of public record in which he is falsely accused. Curiously enough, the one unshakable defense against the charge of libel and slander is the truth of the statement at issue. Truth is our defense against the charge of false witness, slander, and libel. We are perfectly entitled to assume the truth, then, of any serious public accusation which is not challenged by the victim under the laws of slander and libel in a courtroom. Also, I believe we must recognize that we are all free to make of the truth what deductions and evaluations we choose. That is, having determined what is true, I have the personal liberty to think what I choose about it. To deny any man that liberty of evaluation of the import of a truth is to deny the whole fabric of liberty of conscience. While the Ninth Commandment remains intact in the criminal code of most of the United States, it is not only ignored in the vast operation of administrative laws of the burgeoning welfare state, but it is aggressively defied and broken. All of the agencies of the government that administer the various welfare programs must have access to informers in order to function. An informer in this administrative system furnishes rumors, tips, and accusations upon which investigators may begin to hound their prey. Guilt under administrative law is not the proof of commission of a crime against God, but a slip in the performance of routine activities. Therefore, the victim must prove his innocence, and he cannot tell what constitutes innocence. The truth or falsehood of the informer's accusation is not important. It merely opens up the case for probing. The false informer is useless if he must account for the truth or falsity of his witness. Any informer. Not only that, but his very identity must be kept secret, for he is liable to private reprisals from his victims, since they have been furnished, as soon as they have been finished with by the bureaucrats. And the informer is not so willing to furnish tips to keep the investigators going if he has no protection. One of the most familiar regulations to Americans is that governing the examination of our income tax returns. Under the authority of Congress, the Bureau of Internal Revenue has decreed in regulations effective now how informers are to be used and protected by all the powers of the United States government. And I quote now from the law. It says, a district director may approve such reward as he deems suitable for information that leads to the detection and punishment of any person guilty of violating any internal revenue law or conniving at the same. After giving much detail about how the reward shall be paid, the regulations state further that, and I quote, no unauthorized person shall be advised of the identity of the informant. The only authorized persons are those connected with paying the reward or pursuing the investigation. The accused is not to know the identity of the informant. That the informant system is inherent in a government that is engaged in regulating life instead of punishing crime is clear in the experience of Great Britain. Here is a case of the Milk Board tribunals in that country. These special courts were set up in 1932 to police the laws regulating the distribution of milk. According to George Widner, formerly a solicitor for the Supreme Court of New Zealand, writing in the Freeman, a British lawyer was horrified when he first witnessed a trial before one of these tribunals. He saw the accused pronounced guilty and heavily fined on the hearsay evidence of the board's own servants. Mr. Widner reports responsible opinion to the effect that the head of the welfare department is in England subject to a merely formal legal control and is beyond all effective judicial supervision. In other words, the accused has no case to bring against anyone who might bear false witness against him, and no court in which he can plead for redress. The bearing of all this on careless name-calling in public pronouncements is painfully evident. Men of purpose and conviction have never been slow to call a spade or a liar a liar, but they have always done so under the terrible and awesome knowledge that if one man calls another a liar, one of them is one, and it never paid to be the one. Men who used bold language were prepared to answer for what they said, and they did not retreat with a smile. By the same token, people who are apt to be called to account for false witness and slander and libel usually begin to discover the difference between a real slander and the merely horrified raising of an eyebrow with him? Oh, my dear, not him. Such a display of condemnation would call for an explanation, and it is unlikely that anybody would be impressed to discover that all that was wrong with a person is that he was controversial. After all, wherever Jesus went among men, there was a division because of him. And even so, they could not find witnesses who could agree in their testimony against him, and he had to be condemned illegally. The testimony of his own mouth in answer to the high priest. The council itself became witness to his claim to be Christ, and thus acted as both prosecutor and judge. Surely no man was ever condemned as immoral by Christians on the vague charge of using bad methods. The late Senator McCarthy was roundly condemned for his methods. But the characteristic of his methods, the identifying aspect of them when all was said and done, was simply that they were his. Nobody ever told what was wrong with them. They may or may not have been attractive, but it is hard to understand how they could be subject to an accusation by a witness responsible before God and the law and the general public. And so, as public sensitivity wanes, and administrative law replaces regular judicial processes, the way is speedily prepared for the bully inquisitor who knows no restraint and operates with the full terror of untrammeled force of government. Now unto God the Father, and God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost, be ascribed as his most justly due all might, dominion, majesty, and power, now and forevermore.